Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We're sorry, the number you have dialed is not in service at this time.
Hello, and welcome to the World Cricket Show with me, Adam Bayfield, and Tony Kerr.
Hey.
Tony, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Yeah, good. Just, you know, getting to grips with life in lockdown.
Yeah, with our new lives. Yeah, we are, as you say, in lockdown here in Guernsey, so we're recording this podcast over Skype. We've got the video open. It looks like you're in bed, Tony.
Yeah, I haven't really moved, to be fair. Yeah, a bit of a developing situation, obviously, with you know, the coronavirus and all that. So, a bit like, yeah, so the kind of the measures that our government here in Guernsey, as you know, have been sort of implementing, have kind of ratcheted up day by day almost, haven't they, over the last kind of, like, I don't know, 2 weeks, 10 days. But yeah, this is day three of working from home. Day one of, like, I guess what you would call effective lockdown in Guernsey. But yeah, day three of working from home. Day one, I had a great setup. So I live with my girlfriend in the flat. Great setup on the kitchen table. Both of us were there, happy as Larry. Then sort of Monday afternoon, which was day one, she's moved in a monitor that she'd kind of looted from work. And I was kicked off the kitchen table by the end of Monday.
So your real estate.
I was then onto the sofa on Monday.
You've been watching The Wire, Tone. Have you learned nothing?
Yeah, I know. I need to go and get that corner back. And then anyway, day two of home working, settling into my new life on the sofa, my girlfriend decided that I was hogging too much of the bandwidth and her Skype calls were like, you know, were jumping around all over the place. So I've been kicked off the Wi-Fi now as well. So I'm now exclusively tethered to my phone. And then day three, I've just resigned myself to not getting out of bed.
These sound like very creative excuses that your girlfriend is coming up with to move you further and further away from her in the apartment.
Yeah, I mean, like,
I actually did think to myself, this is not a joke, I actually did think to myself at one point, one of the people I feel most sorry for in this lockdown situation is Tony's girlfriend. I can't think of anyone I'd less like to spend lockdown with than you, Tony. No offense.
Thanks, mate. Well, it's like lockdown inception. I'm in my own personal lockdown within lockdown. So, but yeah, how are you coping?
Yeah, no, all fine here. I'm locked down with my girlfriend and baby, who luckily is young enough that is just completely oblivious to this, and nothing is really different. It's basically just like, you know, like any other day. But no, I mean, it must be tough. Yeah, it must be much tougher for people with multiple kids, or kids of school age who are kept home from school. You know, it's much more of a challenge. But yeah, things pretty much continuing as normal here. We just have to, you know, stay at home all the time. It's strange times, really, Tony, isn't it? I mean, that's probably something of an understatement. I certainly hope that everyone listening to this is well and safe and getting through this. As we mentioned, it's lockdown in Guernsey. All sports has been cancelled. Now, in your day job, Tony, you're the sports reporter for ITV Channel TV. So what are you doing?
Well, have you done it in like a sort of like commercial radio voice?
Now, Tony, in your day job, you're the sports reporter for ITV Channel TV. That's here in the Channel Islands. So you were just saying before that you've been working from home. What are you actually doing?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't know, there's a few bits. Basically, everything's obviously cancelled, postponed, canned, or running out of money. So I probably won't come back. So other than that, yeah, no, it's all absolutely rushed off my feet. I'm getting really bored of like covering just things being cancelled at this point. I think everything pretty much now, there's like one thing that's left to be cancelled. So just waiting on that, and then I'll be.
If you have fully devote your days to Football Manager.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's not just in the Channel Islands, of course, where sport has been cancelled. Pretty much all sport all around the globe is on hold at the moment, including cricket. Begs the question what we're going to talk about today, but we've managed to put some content together. It is, though, like being on lockdown, it is quite frustrating, Tone, that, you know, like we're all stuck at home and there's no sport to watch. And in the scheme of things, that seems like a relatively trivial point. And I probably should obviously say that, you know, it sort of goes without saying, you know, the gravity of this situation. And we don't mean to, we're certainly not going to trivialize anything that's happening. But in a way, that seemingly trivial point about there not being sport on actually isn't. And like, I think what one thing that this crisis is bringing home to me is just how important sport is. Now, that's good news for you, Tone, as a professional sports correspondent. It's good to know that you haven't been wasting your life. But it is, you know, it's one of the best things in life, isn't it? It's one of the things that gives life meaning and creates joy. And a world without sport is a much less interesting world, isn't it? Much less enjoyable, much more colourless world. And it's only been a couple of weeks, but that is really being proven already.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, funny enough, me personally, I've quite enjoyed a couple of weeks where there's been nothing happening, because it is like, and you know, even in the Channel Islands, you know, as a one man band on the Channel TV sports desk, yeah, there is quite a lot
Channel
happening.
TV sports beat,
yeah, exactly. They're like, you know, in our relative Channel Island level, there's a lot goes on, and you know, people are really passionate about it and are very passionate that all sports are covered. So actually, just have a couple of weeks off where you don't, like, I'm not having to, like, I don't know, follow something that's happening in the middle of the night if it's someone competing wherever, or like, you know, or running around doing stuff, because yeah, I guess it is the day job. But
that's just a man wanting some time off work, though, isn't it?
Well, it is, but actually it's quite nice. Not it has actually so far been nice. It's a novelty factor at the moment. That personal feeling is a novelty factor, which will wear off pretty quickly, I think, over the next week or two. But you're right, like, in terms of the pure enjoyment that it brings, it's clearly leaving a pretty big hole in
well,
the world.
It's gonna get bigger, because
it's early days.
The point that, you know, a couple of weeks break for someone in your position probably isn't the worst thing, but depending on how long this goes on for, you know, if this lockdown stretches on for months.
Hang on, I'm running out of battery. I'm just going to move to the I'm moving to the kitchen.
Is she going to allow you?
Yeah. Hang on. I've got an emergency plug-in situation. How's that? Hang on, I'll try and work out how I can sit where you might be able to take a. What's I saying?
Well, what I was trying to say is that you know, I can see for someone in your position that you know, a couple of weeks break isn't the worst thing, but if this lockdown stretches on for months, I think we all are really going to start to feel that absence. It is, you know, it's a huge part of life, isn't it? For, you know, obviously not for everyone, but for a lot of people. It is a massive part of life, and to sort of be told that you have to stay home and not have sport makes it all the tougher. But having said all that, another thing that I've thought about it is that in some ways, while it brings home how important sport as a whole is, sort of sport as a concept is, it does also make the kind of nitty gritty of sport, like all the debates that we would normally have on the World Cricket Show, seem much more trivial.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, at this point, who cares about Mancads? Give me some cricket. Give me any cricket. I would bloody love to watch the 100 this weekend.
Big chat. I mean, yeah, I haven't heard the word Mancad for about 2.5 weeks. So, yeah, this is these are heady days.
It feels like something from a different era of human history, doesn't it?
It really does, actually.
I
think that was the moment that it really hit home. Because obviously, we saw the lockdown come, or, you know, the lockdown coming, but certainly, yeah, sport was falling like dominoes, wasn't it? A couple of weeks ago, and you know, the chat was emerging about working from home and all this kind of stuff, and it was that the England Sri Lanka the Sri Lanka tour was kind of holding steadfast for for a little while. You know, they were on the field playing the warm up, and then when that was called or when that was pulled, that was when it became clear there was going to be absolutely nothing to watch.
Yeah, I think, and then Mrs. Brown's Boys is put on in the match of the day slot, just to really rub it in everyone's faces. All right. Well, despite that lack of sport, we are going to attempt to keep the podcast going over the next few weeks and months. Obviously, everyone's kind of taking things a day at a time at the moment, so we'll see. But that's the plan. So to start with today, we've got a few things to talk about. I did a throw out, as you would say, Tane, on the ITV, Channel TV sports desk. I did a throw out on social media asking for suggestions for things that we could talk about. So I thought we could just dive into some of those. So Paul Hilferty says The Test. Now, this is a documentary on Amazon Prime. Is that right, Tane? About the Australian cricket team and its comeback from the sandpaper scandal. Now, we are going to talk about that, but probably not much today because I haven't seen it yet. But I think you've started watching it, Tane, is that right?
Yeah, I've watched the first two episodes.
How many are there?
I think it's 8 or 10.
Wow.
Sort of takes it, right through from Langer's appointment, I guess, to the end of the Ashes. It's interesting. So I was like, oh, brilliant. You know, I'll have that watched by the time we chat.
You've actually made some notes.
I was getting stressed, you know, trying to like fit in my homework. I've actually made a couple of notes. It's one of those things. I started with the best intentions. I was like, oh, I'll make notes. And then you look back at what you've written like three things, two of which you don't really understand what they mean.
Well, one of which is an item for a shopping list.
Toilet roll. Hoard toilet roll. Yeah, you haven't seen any of it yet, have you?
No, not yet.
Yeah,
My question, let's talk about it more next time, but my question really is, is it a kind of PR exercise or is it more interesting than that?
It depends which way you're coming from. I mean, it's pretty glossy. I think, and I haven't watched many of these kind of behind the scenes sports things, you know, like the all or nothings of this world, you know, the Man City documentary or any of that stuff. So I don't know if, you know, they're all like this, because there is a real, there's a real kind of trend for it at the moment, isn't there? It's kind of glossy. I think it is probably pretty PR-y. You don't come away with it, or it's hard to come away with it without, you know, without just good blokes going through your mind. Good blokes comes out about 15 times in each of the first two episodes. You know, they obviously start, I'd kind of forgotten, well, I hadn't obviously forgotten about the ball tampering stuff, but kind of forgotten just, and we obviously spoke about it at the time, just where that left Australia in terms of just who they had available. And, you know, they went off to play their first few series. You know, they went to England, got hammered 5-0 in the ODI series with a team obviously missing a couple of their biggest names, their best players, but there were also several guys out injured and whatnot. So in that sense, and I obviously haven't got to the end of it yet, but I know what happens. it's a fairly it's an impressive transformation that they, you know, in terms of what they get to, and I guess the fact that they then obviously welcome back two very fine players and you know one of the best players of the modern era probably at the moment. It's quite funny. Justin Langer comes across well from the start. You can just see him kind of properly beaming. He just absolutely loves it. It made me laugh. Like they have, it starts with the 5-0 hammering in England that they get, including the, 4-9-6 at Trent Bridge. But they just look pretty dejected, as that one day series kind of wears on. That episode, it starts with them when they come to England for that tour. They go to Belgium, to visit some Australian war graves. From the First World War, and obviously it's quite emotional. You know, it's not a particularly long sequence, but you know, you can see it's pretty affecting yeah, it's yeah, quite interesting to see. But yeah, then they get to the end of the series, they've lost 5-0, and are like sitting around in the team meeting at the end, kind of discussing it, looking pretty dejected. And yeah, Langer's team talk just made me laugh, because he's like, yeah, having just seen his team get absolutely walloped, he's like, oh yeah, you know, we've had a great few weeks. He's like, France, Belgium, and then just basically stops. It's like, oh, you know, we've visited some war graves. Oh, great few weeks.
Job done. Yeah. Great cricket tour, that.
Yeah, really good tour.
Another successful cricket tour.
Very much in, yeah, I mean, that's it. When we, you know, when we were kids and we went on tour and got walloped, we didn't even been to the war graves. It was like, nothing to take home really from it. But yeah,
we didn't even have any memories of war graves.
No, exactly, to
cherish.
But yeah, no, it's quite, it's interesting. It's worth watching, and we'll as you say, we'll talk about it a bit more next time. I think we'll both have a chance to watch it
this week. I've got a lot of time on my hands now, so I will get stuck into that, and maybe we can do a full review next time. This question from Simon Delarue: which cricketer would you choose if you had to self-isolate with one for 14 days? What do you reckon? So I thought of someone for you, Virat Kohli. I thought the two of you in a room, and you can settle your differences once and for all. Finally bury the hatchet.
I was having a good think about this. I mean, it's quite a tough question to answer, really, when you think self-isolation could go on forever, effectively, or at least for months. I mean, some names that sprung to mind: Charles Colville, just to see how annoyed he would get if I answered, "Well, Charles," to every sort of conversation starter or topic. Or
yeah, what do you want for dinner tonight?
Yeah, well, Charles. Otherwise, I thought like it might be nice to have a West Indian legend in the house. You know, obviously, like great times to, you know, lots to talk about, delivered in a fantastic accent. And you know, there are some good characters obviously in there. But potentially like a Brian Lara maybe would be quite fun. He likes to have a good time.
Yeah, I actually, this was my answer. I wrote down Gordon Greenidge or Desmond Haynes, because they're mates of ours, Tane.
Yeah,
mates
true.
Of ours already.
Pals. Nothing will get better though. You know, it would be a step down from sort of overlooking a Barbadian Bilbaian beach with a glass of white wine. I thought like Elise Perry, if not in the least sleazy way. You know, she's good at football as well, although she's done her hammy, hasn't she, at the moment?
Keepy-uppy with her in the living room.
Yeah, no, but like, you could play two sports and, you know, yeah.
And what?
Talk about all the stuff.
Where's Emily right now? I thought Greenidge or Haynes. I mean, the obvious answer, I guess, is Graham Swann, isn't it? Just the banter, I think, would keep you entertained, no?
I don't know. Vaughan, could you live with Vaughan?
Yeah, Vaughan and Swann would be a good combo, I think.
Gower, I could definitely do a couple of weeks with Gower, I think.
He's a mate of yours as well.
Yeah, well, very civilised.
This question from Brett Ambrose. This is more of a kind of serious cricket question, which is unusual when I do one of these throughout. Why is Keaton Jennings an opening batsman when he seemingly can't play pace but is excellent against spin? So it's a good question, because it does seem slightly counterintuitive in a way, doesn't it? Because he you know, we've talked about this, like he was called up, England called him back into the squad for the Sri Lanka tour that's now been cancelled, on the basis that he has had a lot of success on the subcontinent. You know, he's been awful everywhere else, but he has had success on the subcontinent because he is a very good player of spin. And it does seem strange that he's an opening batsman. You know, obviously from three downwards, you have to play pace as well, but you're more likely, I suppose, to play some spin. Whereas as an opener, you know, you're guaranteed to at least start your innings against pace. Although, mind you, at this point, if Jennings was coming in at number six and Shane Warne was bowling, I think, you know, it'd be a fairly negligent captain who didn't kind of yank Warne out of the attack and bring his best fast bowlers on, because he just has been so fragile, so frail against pace. I mean, I don't really know the answer to this question. So, I mean, I'm just wondering if does Keaton Jennings have the same problems against pace as at county level
as he has at test level. And I just wonder, you know, is it more a function of the fact that, more a result of the fact that there is that gap between domestic and international cricket, and arguably nowhere is that more pronounced than in the quality of the pace bowling. You know, I think Jennings has just discovered that, as, you know, this is a bit brutal, but was kind of found out against, you know, your Mohammed Shamis and your Kemal Roaches in a way that he just, you know, he just didn't face that kind of examination in county cricket. So, you know, that's maybe my theory there.
I feel like this is a bit harsh on Keith Jennings. He's probably, you know, like the Sri Lanka tour got canned, and he's probably thinking like, oh, you know, just be good to listen to a bit of, you know, take my mind off things. You know, got me a bit of time on my hands. He's not even playing cricket, and people are still talking about his fragility in the face of pace. So, yeah.
Well, listen, blame Brett Tone. It's Brett's question. I'm just answering the questions as best I can, delivering content to the...
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
People, there's a suggestion here from someone calling himself Rob Lowe. I don't know if that's his real name, or I don't know if it is in fact the Rob Lowe. It's possible. He's asking us to select a composite 11 of batsmen whose career average was below 40 and bowlers whose career bowling average was above 30. The 30s 11, if you will. So, you know, I don't know, would you say this is a sort of like all-time great mediocre 11, something like that?
I like this.
Rob adds, all-rounders with bowling averages in the 20s are permitted, but would not be allowed to bowl for this team. And I love this suggestion, Tony. This is an amazing suggestion.
Well, I'm just quickly going into stats guru because I forgot to do any research on this.
I don't think you're going to have a hard time putting one together in the next 30 seconds.
Well, just give me 2 minutes to at least get some names up.
It's weird because I obviously can't see your screen, but 90% of the time we've been on this Skype call, you've just looked absolutely baffled. Just peering at me. You're obviously on Crick Info now, are you?
here we go. So, just remind me of the criteria.
Okay, so batsmen whose career batting average was below 40 and bowlers whose career bowling average was above 30. But I guess it's like you've got to pick the best 11 in those criteria. So, you know, you're not picking Keaton Jennings. You know, you're picking players who actually had very good careers, but their averages don't necessarily show that.
I'm presuming you're not going to pick like Jack Callis.
Well, no, because because his bowling average is in the 30s. You mean?
Yeah,
you could pick him, but you'd have to pick him as one of your bowlers.
Yeah. I'm not having him in there. I just thought you might have put him in there. Just
no. I haven't got Callis. Do you want to hear my team?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so. Buckle up. Opening batsman, Michael Atherton and Marvin Attapassi. So Atherton averaged 37.69, scored 16 hundreds in his test career and is one of my favourite cricketers ever. Attapassi averaged 39.02, also 16 hundreds. Both, you'd say, had very good test careers, yet both average in the 30s. Number three, it's the A-team. So far, we've got Atherton, Attapassi, now Astle. Nathan Astle, average 37. Then rounding out my middle order, I've got Carl Hooper, average of 36.46 with the bat, and also was a, you know, quite effective off-spin bowler as well, bowling average in the 40s, I believe. Then Brendan McCullum, who I've got in there as a specialist batsman, average of 38.64. Any thoughts so far, Tone, on the batsman?
Liking it. It's got a very post-Atherton era feel to it.
Yeah, I mean, it is largely post-Atherton. Well, in fact, it is exclusively post-Atherton, yeah. Because that's sort of where I tend towards, because I just think they're players that I've seen, you know, I feel sort of slightly less qualified to talk about players that I haven't seen.
Yeah, so that should just be added to the clarifications. Thank you.
That's true. That's true. Thanks very much for that. Tony, so I've got an all-rounder in at six, Andrew Flintoff. For me, one of the greatest England players of all time, would be a strong candidate for a post-Atherton 11. Batting average of 31.77, bowling average of 32.78. So the numbers don't really support that. It was all about the moments, wasn't it? And the big moments in the big series. As a wicketkeeper, I've got MS Dhoni.
Big
average
shout.
38.09 with the bat. And then
can I guess your bowlers?
Yeah, you can. I've got four specialist bowlers.
Yeah.
Who are you guessing?
I reckon you're going to have Steve Harmison.
Nope.
Fuck. One down.
One down, three to go.
You're going to have Matthew Hoggard, surely.
Correct.
Yes. Yeah. Come on.
30.5 was his bowling average. Took 248 wickets. And there's another of my favourite cricketers ever.
I reckon.
So you said Harmison, then Hoggard. There is another H.
You talking about your spinner here?
Well, I'll give you a clue. I've actually got two spinners. So, yeah, one of my two spinners.
Well, I suspect one will be Harbhajan then.
Correct. So he averaged 32 with the ball. 417 wickets. He has the most wickets of anyone with an average in the 30s.
And then I think you're going to have Daniel Vettori in there.
No, I flirted with Vettori. I flirted with him extensively, but I ended up with Nathan Lyon. 390 wickets, so not far behind Harbhajan. We'll almost certainly go past him. Average 31.58.
So, hang on, are you trying to put together the best team to win a match that you could from the 30s?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Tim.
Okay.
Cool. Have you just worked that out?
No, I thought you were doing it with sort of your favourite players of the third, you know.
No, this is a team I'd want to put on the field.
You'd have to make some tough decisions.
So we've got one player left, fast bowler.
I don't know, Brett Lee.
Correct, yeah. 310 wickets, average 30.81. So let me run that through for you, Tone. Atherton, Atapattu, Astle, Hooper, McCullum, Flintoff, Dhoni, Lee, Hoggard, Harbhajan, Lyon. Now, what do you think about that team? To me, that actually seems like quite a good team.
This is the thing with, you know, when we did it, didn't we? The team of the decade, the team of the this, that, and the other is there are obviously those like just freaks of nature, the outliers, the ones that are going to be in every single greatest 11 that's ever put together. But yeah, this is interesting. I think there's a bit about that team.
Yeah, and it's nice to give some sort of airtime, some credit to some of those players. That you know, someone like Astle or Hoggard is never going to get in a post-Atherton World 11, but they were extremely effective cricketers for a long time. And, you know, does it say something as well that perhaps averages are overrated, or we read too much into averages? I mean, you know, obviously Astle with an average of 37, clearly Sangakkara and Tendulkar and Lara are much better batsmen than Nathan Astle was, but, you know, he was probably a better batsman than an average of 37 would suggest.
Yeah, I think there's merit in that. I mean, yeah, as you said before, certainly someone like Flintoff, on paper, statistically, yeah, not in the top tier, but you know, he wouldn't be far off in the conversation of greatest all rounders, just in terms of sheer kind of force of nature.
Well, and perhaps a nice segue talking about Flintoff there, and you know, it was the big moments, you know, him delivering on the big stage. Big moments, and of course, most famously in the 2005 Ashes. So, the last thing for us to talk about today, this suggestion from Matt Downham, and it was actually echoed by an email from another listener, Ben Bishop. So two people wanted us to talk about this. Matt Downham says, just a long rambling chat about how effing brilliant the 2005 Ashes were. Now, I'm always up for this. So speaking of our kind of lack of sport at the moment, this feeling kind of bereft of sport, one of the ways I filled that void this week was by watching some of the 2005 Ashes. So there's a video on YouTube, which is a documentary that Channel 4 put out, I guess, like at the end of the series or a month or so after the series, called Ashes Fever. I sent you a link to this, I think. Did you watch it, Tony? Did you watch any of it?
Well, yeah, some of it.
I mean, I don't know about you, but before I'd even got to the end of Mambo Number 5, I was blubbing. The nostalgia is so intense for me, I just couldn't handle it. One thing that's quite weird about it is that, like, I turned it on and I was like, oh, this would be a nice escape from the kind of grim reality that we're living through at the moment. So you get through Mambo Number 5, and then Mark Nicholas goes, summer 2005, England is in the grip of a highly contagious virus. Millions will get the bug. And I was like, wait, what is going on? It was very strange. But he was talking about Ashes Fever.
Sounds like an altogether more desirable desirable contagion.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Those were the days, when all you had to worry about was Ashes Fever.
It was catching Ashes Fever. Well, having rewatched that documentary, Tone, I've come to the conclusion that the 2005 Ashes was pretty much the best thing ever. I mean, it was for us. Not only was it the cricket itself and the series, which is surely the best Test series in living memory, possibly of all time, but for us as well. You know, it's such a kind of, it was a once in a lifetime summer, wasn't it, Tone? We just finished school in 2005. It was this kind of long and glorious summer before we all up sticks and went off to university, and it's such a unique moment in time.
Yeah, I'm very lucky.
You're looking a bit like you don't remember it. Do you remember any of it?
You know what my memory's like. I mean, this is the thing. It probably until this summer, and I guess, well, the World Cup final, the Stokes Headingley heroics, you know, you'd be hard pressed. That's probably as close as we've got, I think. Well, I mean, it probably matched it, to be fair, to 2005. But in terms of sustained, just like gripping cricket over the course of a summer. But I think we mentioned it at the time of Stokes' Headingley innings. Yeah. The way that series was set up, where it was this kind of this all-time great, probably the greatest, well, in the conversation for greatest team ever, Australian side, who we'd grown up watching destroy England time and time again. I don't know. It wasn't. It's not quite David v Goliath and David Toplin Goliath, because England were obviously a very good side. They weren't like enormous underdogs, but there was that mental
barrier.
Mentally underdogs, yeah, for sure. Mm. And you dare to believe that it might be possible, kind of going into the series, and then the way it started, it was like, oh shit, it's going to be tough. But just the turnaround, Edgbaston, the whole Edgbaston test is one of the great things of all time in any thing.
Very, very eloquently put. Beautifully phrased.
Thanks. But you're right, though. It was for us. It was pretty special, wasn't it? I mean, like the real mark, Euro 96, Ashes 2005, probably the two great sporting extravaganzas. And London 2012, I guess, as well.
Yeah, London 2012. They're probably the three.
Yeah. But yeah, as you say, like, yeah. I vividly remember that summer and lots of things about it. Definitely more so than most other summers or most other periods, really. But yeah, I was doing a bit of gardening that summer. And I remember I couldn't.
Yeah, you're working as a gardener, you mean?
I was working as a gardener, not just doing my own garden.
Yeah.
But yeah, I remember listening to the first balls of the first test in the little van parked. I can vividly remember it. And then I'd be really excited about series, but not being able to watch that. And I think we sort of finished each day relatively early, like 2-ish. So it would be an early start, then finish at 2. But then I did like a few days of gardening early on in the summer. And then as the cricket developed, I just did less and less gardening, to the point where I think I just like gave up. I just stopped turning up and was just watching the cricket at that point.
I find that really hard to believe, Tony, that your work ethic at that time wasn't super strong. Well, I think, as you were saying before, I think one thing that is easy to forget about that series is just how good that Australia team was. And also that we had never in our lifetime seen England beat Australia. And it seemed impossible. It seemed like something that was never going to happen. For all that the drama of Stokes and everything last summer perhaps touched those same sort of heights, it just didn't have that same, quite the same narrative.
No, you're right. And the victory at Edgbaston was that moment where it was the David Flooring Goliath moment, really, in a way. It was like, it is possible. And then from there, obviously, history unfolded.
Like, it's just an amazing narrative. Like, the narrative of this kind of young England team coming together in 2004, building momentum, winning in South Africa, which in itself was improbable, and then sort of taking down the best team of all time. It was just amazing. And I... watching that documentary was interesting because I remember so much of it so clearly, but in watching it, because I haven't watched the footage for a long time, like it's just kind of burned on my, you know, in my retinas. So I do remember so much of it so clearly, but in watching the documentary, you quite quickly realize that it is a long time ago now. A couple of ways that stood out to me. One, Richie Beno and Tony Gregg, both commentating. And two, no DRS. And of course, it would have been a completely different series had there been DRS. It's not as straightforward as just saying, oh, well, you know, Australia would have won at Edgbaston because Kasparovic wasn't actually out off that last ball. You know, his hand was off the bat when it hit his glove. It's not as simple as that, because obviously had there been DRS, that would have affected other things throughout the series. But it certainly, it would have played out differently, and it might have played out more in Australia's favour. I wrote down some notes, Tone, watching this documentary, just kind of moments or things that happened that watching the documentary still kind of raised the hairs on the back of my neck. So you mentioned you listened in the van. Harmison on the first day, that Harmison spell and cutting Ponting's cheek. Something that I had somewhat forgotten about, Ashley Giles at Edgbaston, like the fact that England stuck with Giles when he... you know, had taken such a battering in the press after the first test. They stuck with him and he actually bowled really well and took some crucial wickets in that Edgbaston test. That was, you know, it's kind of spine-tingling watching him celebrate getting Ricky Ponting out with Michael Vaughan. That Flintoff over at Edgbaston, I just wrote, my notes just wrote down, that Flintoff over, f*** off. Trent Bridge, England made Australia follow on at Trent Bridge, and that was their first follow on in 191 tests, which again is, you know, sort of illustrates just how good that Australia team was. It was not since the 1980s that they had to follow on. And I seem to remember, now tell me if I'm wrong, my memory of this, when England were in that run chase at Trent Bridge, when they had to chase 120 odd to win, and Warne was spinning it sideways and you know, and ripping out England batsmen, and suddenly it's, you know, it seemed like it was all falling apart and everyone's heart was in their mouth. My memory of this is that you were somewhere like the V Festival and you were calling me for updates on what was happening. And each time you called me, I had to be like, another one's out. Does that ring a bell?
Do you know, having said, I've got vivid memories about all of that. I'd forgotten about that. That does ring a massive bell.
Yeah, I think you were there. And I seem to remember you ringing as Geraint Jones had skied one up into the air. I almost jumped out the window when he was caught. And I picked up and I was like, Jones is out! but obviously eventually got there. Simon Jones's spell in that test as well. I mean, it's genuinely heartbreaking, Tone, that was his final test. Because watching that spell, you're like, well, this guy's going to be the best bowler in the world. And sorry, just two more things. Something that still kind of, still gets me is the talking about how England sort of took down that brilliant Australia team. It was the intelligence with which I did it, with which they did it. you know, obviously Michael Vaughan now has made a career in a certain way.
Yeah.
But he was such a brilliant, such an astute captain.
The Katie Hopkins of cricket.
Exactly. And the plans that they put in place for the Australian batsmen, like that, I mean, the fly slip for Damian Martin, that kind of short mid-off for Matthew Hayden, extra cover for Justin Langer so that he couldn't get those square cut fours away and frustrating him. you know, it was just, it was brilliant. And as an England fan, so satisfying to watch those plans be executed and pay off, you know, watching Damian Martin, top edge one to fly slip. It was fantastic as an England fan. And I love that. And one final thing, I remember so clearly the moment where, not when I knew England were going to win the Ashes, because it was way too early for that, but the moment where I thought this actually might happen was in the Old Trafford test, Jason Gillespie misfielding, just letting a ball go through his legs for four, and Glenn McGrath just standing there, hands on hips, you know, teapot, and the England fans all like roaring. It was just this kind of rocking atmosphere. And I was like, this actually might happen. And it did. As you may be able to tell from the passion in my voice, this is genuinely one of the great memories of my life.
And speaking of the test, you know, obviously, like, Langer trying to get the best out of, you know, what, with all due respect to those players, or a lot of those players who were there at the start of his tenure, it was quite an average side. And, you know, on his coaching team, he's got, you know, he's got Gilchrist there, Ponting's there. The aura around those players still, as like, yeah, you know, as guys who've been retired for a fair number of years now, it's incredible. And you know, Kevin Peterson, and he is one of my favourite England players of all time. And, you know, just such a massive part of why England were able to do that. And I know he's been sort of slightly discredited as well, just by, you know, what happened afterwards. But watching him, even in defeat in that Lord's test, you know, take it to Warne. Yeah, I think what he did in that series was a massive part of why England won it.
It's definitely true. It's easy to forget how ridiculous the skunk was, though, isn't it?
Oh, no, absurd. Like, it was, yeah. What, you know, even, I don't know. I don't remember even what I made of it at the time.
No. No, you're probably like, legend at the time. I want to be like him when I grow up.
But yeah, that was huge. Like, you know, England had always been so, like, feeble at times against Australia. And, yeah, for Peterson, and then, you know, whether what he did in that first test or just his presence kind of coming into it, you know, brought the best out of other players as well in terms of their mentality, attitude and stuff. Obviously, you know, into that second test at Edgbaston, you know, it was a flint-off-driven victory, wasn't it? But yeah, so much to enjoy. And when you just look at that team, that Triscothic.
Yeah.
Come on.
That's all you have to say.
Yeah.
I'm blubbing.
You know.
Obviously, we've spoken a lot there about England and how brilliant that England team was. But it is like, I certainly didn't appreciate this at the time. I was going to say took it for granted, but that's not even really the right expression. Like, I just thought the opposite of this. Like, how amazing that Australia team was and how lucky we were to watch them in their pomp. And at the time, you know, obviously I was a bit younger, more, a less mature individual at the time, but, you know, they were just annoying. It was just annoying that they were so good. But looking back now, it's like what a privilege it was to watch McGrath and Warne and Ponting and Gilchrist and Hayden and Langer and all the others, you know, all in the same team. Having said, I don't like to make sweeping statements, you know, about eras of cricket that I haven't seen, but it's hard to think that there are many better teams than that have ever played the game. You know, probably the West Indies team in the 1980s are the only other one in the conversation, aren't they?
Yeah, well, we didn't see that, so.
Yeah, and so it just had everything, that series. It really did. And obviously for that England team, it was so brilliant, but it all kind of fell apart after that, didn't it? Like that team never took the field together again. Simon Jones never played again. You know, they kind of gradually slipped down the rankings. They lost 5-0 in Australia 18 months later. And that, at the time, that was obviously very disappointing. But I just wonder if in some ways it makes 2005 even more special. It just was this kind of perfect moment in time that was never to be repeated. And means that, you know, I'll never, ever forget some of those moments.
Yeah, there hasn't really been a series that's kind of come close to that. I guess this summer was pretty special, last summer was pretty special, and came close. But yeah, I think as we said after the conclusion of the last Ashes series, it, in terms of the full package, 2005 remains the best that we've seen.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think objectively that just is true, but we do have to be a bit careful because, yeah, we were 18 and it was our kind of summer of love. and it just, it is completely different to last summer when I was, you know, working a full-time job and looking after a baby and not really able to actually watch much of the cricket live. It was just a totally different set of circumstances for me. So I can think you have to take that into account. But I do think, taking all of that into account and trying to be objective, I just think 2005 is the best test series there has been in our lifetime by a reasonable distance. And as I say, I will never forget it. Well, I think we need to probably leave it there for today, Tony. Your girlfriend just got you to shut the door because she's getting fed up of our yakking.
Yeah, and you can blame her, really. It's only, yeah, day one of full lockdown.
Maybe we should do one of these podcasts every night.
Maybe we should go through just 1 to 11 in that 2005 England team and just do an episode about each player.
I mean, I'm up for that. I was going to say, like, you know, we said at the top, we want to keep the podcast going as best we can during this this difficult time. And, you know, obviously I would be surprised at this point if there's much or any cricket at all in England this summer. So we're going to need content, is what I'm saying. We're going to need ideas for content. I'm very happy to just talk about 2005 on every show. but if listeners want us to talk about something else, write in. Send us your questions and suggestions via the internet. You can check us out on Facebook at Cricket Show. You can check us out on Twitter at Cricket Show, Instagram at World Cricket Show, or send us an email, worldcricketshow@gmail.com.
Yeah, the cricket season at the moment, I mean, you know, for the winter sports, it's obviously the situation is pretty, and yeah, the overused word, unprecedented, but, you know, at least there's some sort of, they've got some sort of clarity for cricket. I mean, who knows what it's going to look like? I mean, what's going to be left?
Yeah, I think next autumn is really best case scenario at the moment, isn't it? So it's difficult days, Tony, difficult days all around. And as we say, yeah, very much hope everyone listening to this is safe and well. We will do our best to keep this going. Just spread a little joy with our numerous discussions of 2005 Ashes. Perhaps, you know, maybe for Australian fans, that's the opposite of spreading joy, I don't know.
Yeah, true.
We've sort of anti-joy we've brought them today. But yeah, all right, well, thanks, Tone. Hopefully yeah, this mate. Is recorded. It was left up to you to record the show today, so we'll see whether it worked or not.
Yeah, I was in the producer's chair today.
You've looked quite baffled at various points, so hopefully that wasn't... you know, that isn't a bad sign. But yeah, stay safe out there, everyone. I won't say stay in school because all the schools are closed. So you finally got an excuse.
Stay home.
To not go to school. Stay home, exactly.
Stay at home.
Stay at home. And we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, cheers, mate.
Cheers, Tone. Bye for now.
Cheers. I can smell your fear. Ba da da ba ba, ba da da ba ba. Ba da da ba ba, ba da da ba ba. Ba da da ba ba, ba da da ba ba. Ba da da ba ba, ba da da ba ba.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.